I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
There's been a thought experiment that I've been playing around with lately, and I think you guys have both seen it.
Uh-oh.
No, this isn't bad. This isn't like an intervention or something, okay. Sam.
I'm not going to... you're not Stanford Prison experiment.
No. There's going to be some pills under your chair. you want to put that under your tongue. And we're going to show you a movie. No, nothing like that.
That's not new, Mike. That's not new.
And you're going to be asked a series of questions, and you'll be given the button. So I've been thinking a lot about franchises lately, not because I want to bitch about them.
Like McDonald's?
Not like that kind of...
Oh, okay.
But I guess you could say McDonaldland could fit under this category.
It's all the same now.
Yes, it is.
It does kind of feel all the same now. I've been thinking about that, and I think that because we live in a media environment where we have these fictional worlds that oftentimes have what I think is the illusion of being expansive and immersive, and they feel like they have the potential for infinite stories. And I'm kind of toying around with my own version of a Bechdel test. You guys are familiar with the Bechdel test?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so if anyone who's a listener doesn't know what the Bechdel...
For the record, my last name is Mulvey.
Mulvey, okay.
Yeah, okay.
So the Bechdel test was created in a comic strip by cartoonist Alison Bechdel. So the Bechdel test was, in a movie, is there a scene where two female characters with names talk to each other about something other than a man? The idea being, holy shit, it's kind of shocking how many times a movie can't meet that very small goal.
Right.
And maybe we should have more of that in movies in the future. Not that a movie is bad because it fails the Bechdel test. It's not that it's not feminist if it doesn't meet the Bechdel test. By the way, there is one line that passes the Bechdel test all at once. Get away from her, you bitch. from Aliens. But I was thinking about my own version of the Bechdel test, about sort of media franchises and world building. And I have the tentative name of it of 2 degrees from Luke Skywalker.
Okay.
Yeah. Casey and I have talked about this a bit.
We have not.
We have not. I thought it came up on the Discord, but I wasn't sure if you'd heard about it.
A lot of things happen on the Discord that I don't see.
It's okay. It's okay. Yeah. They stay on the Discord.
Yeah.
Well, certainly, not always. Since the people listening to this are Patreon sponsors, you can go on the website and get an invite to the Discord, Radio versus the Martians Discord server.
Oh, we're in the show now.
There's no gatekeeping at all. Yes,
no,
we're in
none.
The show. Yes, we are recording.
Yes. We've always been recording you, Sam.
I've always been afraid of that.
So the idea of this is, okay, just pick a media franchise, whether it's Star Trek, Star Wars, Tolkien's Middle Earth, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, anything that has multiple installments with a bunch of characters, and the sense that it could be expansive. Okay, now choose an iconic central character. You know, like if the franchise is going to advertise itself or have a t-shirt, what's the character they're going to put on that t-shirt? It might be the main character. It might just be a really central character. For the sake of Star Wars and the name of this thought experiment, it's Luke Skywalker. That Luke Skywalker, though I think you can make the argument that that character for Star Wars is Darth Vader.
Right.
I think as long as you can make the argument that this is the character, Mr. Spock for Star Trek.
Sure.
Sure.
You could say Bilbo Baggins for Middle Earth, but I think realistically it's probably more like Gandalf.
Right.
And for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it'd be like Tony Stark. So the idea is, let's start with Luke Skywalker, because that's who it's named after.
Most marketable character, not necessarily most important character. Is that what you're aiming for here?
Like a central character, the most iconic character.
Okay.
The character that the franchise centers itself on to a certain degree. Okay, so now the question becomes, are there any movies, TV shows, stories, etc. set in that world where there are zero characters that have been in the same room as that central character? So with the question of like Luke Skywalker, you can say it about Darth Vader too. Let's just say Luke Skywalker for the sake of clarity. Are there any installments of Star Wars, the movie, the TV show, anything, where there are zero characters that have been in the same room with Luke Skywalker?
Well, I can't speak to Star Wars anymore because I long checked out of that
I'm pretty
noise.
Checked out of that. But the thing is, the point that the thought experiment is making is that despite the fact that Star Wars feels like this big expansive universe, they seem really unwilling to move away from that core.
Yeah.
That obviously Luke Skywalker is in all of the first 7 or 8 movies. And he shows up as a ghost in the last one. So none of those are all out.
Right.
Luke Skywalker's there, so people who've been in the room with Luke Skywalker are also there. Then you go, okay, Rogue One. Okay, well, Darth Vader's been in the same room with Luke Skywalker. The droids have been in the same room with Luke Skywalker. Then you go to all the short stories that involve everyone in the cantina. They've all been in the same room with Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
So it's weird, but for one season, The Mandalorian met that bar. Then it dropped off in the second season because then it turned into a show about backdoor pilots. Not to complain and rehash that again, but then the same thing with like Star Trek, Mr. Spock.
Backdoor pilots, I think that's my search history. I think.
Backdoor pilots, that's a very specific. It's all Sully porn. But so, like, Mr. Spock is in all of original Star Trek.
Jeez, thanks for that image, Mike. Thanks.
Yes.
Thanks.
The only characters in Star Trek The Next Generation that are, like, recurring, that are in the same room with Mr. Spock, are, like, Picard, Data. What was the name of Tasha Yar's Romulan daughter? It's like, Sela?
Sela.
She's in the same room with Spock, but most of the other characters haven't been. So when O'Brien and Worf go over to Deep Space Nine, Deep Space Nine becomes a show where nobody has been in the room with Mr. Spock.
Until they do that weird, you know, anniversary episode where they just redo Tribbles.
Oh, shit, I forgot. Oh, dun, God. Dun, dun. We just knocked Deep Space Nine off of it because they have been in the room with Spock.
Yeah, literally.
Fuck. See, that's what I'm talking about. Is that you just go, are you willing to go far enough away from the core? So I think Voyager still has zero characters that have been in the room with Spock.
No.
Tuvok has been in the room with Sulu.
I'm sure Tuvok has been in the room with Spock, and that's probably in the dialogue.
Well, and on screen. Has he ever been in the room on screen?
Okay, gotcha.
Because then this is the thing I was thinking about, too, because I was thinking about Dune, and I'd say that would be Paul Atreides. Paul Atreides is the initial character that they would put on t-shirts and stuff for Dune.
Yeah.
And then
book 4, everyone's dead.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He's been in the same room with his son, and this is the thing that I think makes my thought experiment fall apart, which is characters that are functionally immortal, because his son lives for thousands of years.
Yes, Leto the Tyrant, runs the Emperor, or there is the Emperor of the Known World, or of the Known Universe, for 3,500 years.
And he's in the room with a lot of people.
And he not only has been in the room with his dad, he is his dad.
Yeah.
His dad floats around as a space ghost inside of his head.
So yeah.
And he shows up in the third book, just as a cameo. Like literally in the middle of the third
book.
Why
is Paul Atreides' son functionally immortal? What's his deal?
Because you want the most memeable character in Dune. It's not Paul. It's Leto the Tyrant. Because what he does is he basically coats himself in worm.
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
Becomes a worm man.
Okay.
And he's about as big as a bus by the time of the third book.
So he's like a worm person, and worms, the regular sandworms, they do live on like thousands of years. They have like thousands of years.
Yeah, they are effectively immortal.
Okay.
Because for ecological reasons, because that's kind of the nerdery that Frank Herbert was about.
I mean, there's the whole, sorry to go off on a tangent, but now that we've got a Dune expert in the room, I have to ask, like, they're humans for the most part, and then the spice extends their lifespan.
Yeah.
So, like, what is the, if you're like a rich person and you can afford spice, what's like a human being's spice, spice added lifespan normally? How long do people live?
I think triples the lifespan.
Oh,
like,
triples.
I don't think
okay.
I've heard anybody older than who hadn't made the jump to Guild Navigator who had lived beyond a century or two.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
See, that you're right. The Dune is also one of the things where it's be like, well, we're just going to tell this story on a time scale that's like on the order of thousands of years, but...
But I'm not sure if Dune counts as under this kind of world, because Dune is like one big generational saga.
Well,
right.
That's the thing is, after... the end of Children of Dune, book mm-hmm. 3. And then you go to book 4, which is God Emperor, and that's 3,500 years later. And Paul makes an appearance as a brain ghost for like one paragraph. And then the next book after that takes place 3,000 years after that. So at that point, we are 6,000 years after Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And no one in the room wants anything to do with the Atreides. In fact, the Atreides gene line is something that the Sisterhood is trying to suppress, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so like, if you were to take the novels as a TV series, mm-hmm. which, well, okay, is something that's going to happen. I don't think they're going to follow the novels. I think they're going to do all the Brian Herbert stuff and... yeah, anyway.
They always cut off before the giant worm man.
They always cut off before the giant worm man because it's like Back to the Future. I don't think you're ready for this.
Yeah.
But your kids are going to love it.
Yeah. They always stop short. But is Leto the Second, the worm man character, does he appear in the last couple books?
No.
So I think...
Unless you count the Brian Herbert books...
Mm-hmm.
Then it's basically Star Wars.
Okay.
No.
Because the extended universe Dune books is literally written by a guy who cut his teeth on like Jedi novels and stuff like that.
That's Kevin J. Anderson?
That is the guy. Mm-hmm. And he's the one doing the writing. Mm-hmm. And Brian's doing the thinking with his because he's got the Herbert Vault. I think it's right next to the Disney Vault, and
it doesn't have Frank Herbert's frozen head in it though, like the Disney Vault.
No, and it doesn't have, and oddly enough, it doesn't have like the weird homophobia of Frank Herbert. That's right up front if you want it. Unlike Disney, moving on,
because Disney's so progressive.
Oh, it's so progressive. Where were we even going with this? What was the question?
the question of whether there are, I mean, right, installments so, where there's
yeah,
characters.
Yeah, by the time you get to the extended stuff where yeah. Brian Herbert is theoretically moving on the notes that his dad left behind, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, pay me. And at that point, it literally is reintroducing all the characters that you love, that you want to see again.
Oh, God.
Who all are really not the characters that you remember at all. Mm-hmm. But now, like, those books have been out for 20 years now, and now I'm meeting Dune fans for whom the extended Dune novels have been just as much as part of their life as the actual Dune novels, and I will always be a Herbert originalist. I can't help it.
It's your prerogative, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are all at our own headcanon.
Yeah.
I mean, again, this is the same thing. I've said this before. There is a Lord of the Rings TV show that's on right now that I have no interest in watching.
But so they did prequel novels of like they did the Great House novels where they did a House Harkonnen, House Atreides, House Carino, and they were all prequel stuff. And then they did... they wrote back and they wrote an, I forget the actual thing, but after that they wrote about the Machine War that like,
yeah.
they referred to.
The
Butlerian Jihad ones. And those novels, I mean, you get to see like where the Harkonnen come from, where the Atreides come from and all that stuff. And it's like very Star Wars. And it has nothing to do with the novels. It's just they have the same last names because of the genesis of those families. And then they circle back and write Dune 7, like, because it famously, Dune's the last Herbert Dune novel ended on this weird-ass cliffhanger that makes no sense to anyone at all, because I think Herbert was like, can I be done now, please? Can I stop writing these novels? I think I've said I want to...
The Conan Doyle problem, where he just kills off his character?
He doesn't kill off his character. Well, I mean, because it's now a universe where like, it's generational storytelling, so people mm-hmm. die all the time. It literally ends with just, like, an old couple in a garden.
Okay.
Hmm.
Like, I don't want to give too much away. Spoilers? I don't know. But it literally is, like, they escape in the no-ship, and then the no-ship is caught by these two old people who keep a garden who are also face dancers, except they're not under control by the Tlilaxu. So, does this make sense to you? No.
No.
It doesn't make sense to me. And it really just felt like Herbert was like, can I be done now?
Yeah.
And then...
Okay, well, to your point about your two steps away from Luke, what about Game of Thrones?
Oh.
What about the larger George R. R. Martin, which
it's a little harder with Game of Thrones.
Everything they're doing right now is like, well, We're just, it's a different time, but you know the last names. You know the family names. You know, these guys got dragons. You know, these guys are on the ocean. Like, these guys are in the north. You know all that. And so it's kind of like they're not the same characters, but you're going to see a Stark, you know? You're
going
to see a Targaryen.
There's a couple characters you can pick from Game of Thrones to be your main one. Probably Daenerys Targaryen is probably the one that they put on. The queen, the Darkarian queen, mother of dragons, all that.
Okay.
She's probably the most memeable character.
Right.
Because Martin has written stories that take place 200 years in the past. He's done a couple that take place at different parts in the timeline. Even in the main series, there's a ton of characters that have never been in the same room with Daenerys because they're on a different continent. So I think he sort of meets that. They're all kind of Westerosi-centric, but there's a lot of space on there for world growth into other places. Like, he did a book co-written with a bubble of people that are in charge of the official, like, Ice and Fire wiki. It got to the point where his world was so
Wiki authors were co-writing with George R. R. Martin?
Yeah, because the thing that happened was they had created a wiki so comprehensive that Martin had to use it to remember the gender of somebody's horse sometimes. And just to remember that sort of stuff is that, and then he would actually use them a lot of time. He's like, hey, I need to remember what the name of this dude's sword is. I remember I named it. And they would come back with this because they were like wiki entries for fucking everything.
So is George R. R. Martin even involved with this prequel business at all? Or
I think he's writing some episodes of the TV show. I think he's also probably trying to get into a headspace that he can go back to the book because, one, there's the stress of all the shit they're throwing at him. But also, I think he's built something that's gotten increasingly complex, and he's a very, I'm going to call this an organic storyteller. He's the less plot-driven, more character-driven, and he needs to get a character to a place where they make a decision or that people are in the right location and the right sequence of events and happening all at the same time, and just so somebody can realistically make a decision. So he will sometimes have a storyline that meanders and takes a really the scenic route, let's say, to get to a place so that somebody can earn the decision that they're going to make. He's very big on that. I think he's referred to his writing style as a gardener. He says there's architects and gardeners, and that the architect is somebody who knows where every bolt, every nail, every board of something they're building is going to be, and then puts it in place. Where he's a gardener, where he drops some seeds in and grows, and it becomes something else maybe. And he has a basic idea at the end, and he kind of knows how he wants it to come together. But sometimes it takes a while to get somebody to move in that direction so that their decisions make sense. And sometimes that frustrates some readers because sometimes you can't just go from point A to point B and have somebody make a decision. Some of my least favorite writing decisions are about somebody suddenly jumping from point A to point B, and you go, wait a minute, I don't know if it really makes sense for them to do that, or it seems really weird. It seems like you're kind of fudging the in-between bit so that this character choice or change or plot difference, you know, whatever it is, it makes sense and it feels earned and real and organic. And he's really big on that, which means sometimes it takes him fucking forever.
Right.
And
I as someone who's a fan of these novels, do you have any expectation that he's actually going to return to them?
I think he's going to finish this next book for sure. I think it's hard to say how much of it he's written. He's been writing it for 11 years.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think I'm an optimist and say he's probably going to finish these books.
Okay.
The thing that I like with the world book that he created is that he wrote it in the universe of A Song of Ice and Fire. So when he's writing about foreign countries, the further away you get from Westeros, the more there's a here there be dragons kind of vibe to it. And also, it's written from the point of view of this scholar living in Westeros, so he has personal biases. And there's places where you wonder, is that a real thing, or is he just racist? because he certainly is probably racist and has a lot of things where you start going, oh, they drink blood over there. And I'm like, do they really?
Yeah.
Do they? And I kind of like that element of it, where the closer they are to that, the homeland of the person there, because again, this is a guy writing a book who's written and learned about things exclusively through other books and hasn't traveled.
The German cookbook problem.
Yeah, it is a German cookbook problem.
Okay, yeah. I should probably explain that.
Please do. I have no idea what you're talking about.
So I think there is a ton of opportunity if Martin finished these books.
Yeah.
Because he also writes other books and other short stories as side projects in this world. And like sometimes he just does that to get his groove back because he wants to get something finished and published. And I don't know. I want him to finish them. I really do. And I think he also has a lot of weight on his shoulders now because everyone seems to hate the way the show ended. I do. And he has a chance to do the quote-unquote real ending. And he can avoid... And he's outright said that his thing is going to end differently than the show did. But there is a lot of opportunity in the seeds that he's planted all over his world map about potential stories that are never going to come back into the books in the main story. They have nothing to do with that. But there's like cultures and worlds, and you can learn about the history and the geography of stuff that ultimately doesn't matter. And I kind of like the sense that there's enough of a sense that we are in a historical context and stuff that it's one of the things I love about both Lord of the Rings and Dune, which is that you're thrown into a world that doesn't feel like it was just created.
Right.
There's a bunch of history that you kind of have to slowly learn to make the world building choices make sense. Like in Dune, it's a question of like, why don't they have computers?
Right.
And that leads to like about five different strands of where the story goes, because if they just had computers and they didn't fight an entire war for humanity against machines, then they wouldn't need spice.
Right.
And then also, everything.
Even more importantly, why are they all carrying swords around?
Exactly.
What the heck is that about?
So there's all these world building
choices.
Because
they fucking look cool, that's why.
Well, I mean, I know how we got there.
Yeah.
But there has to have been but he makes the investment into a story.
Right, right.
To make the fact that they're all walking around, that in this far, 15,000 years in the future, like the leader of this government has a sword master. What the hell is that about? Oh, that sounds cool. I guess I gotta have a reason for that. And instead of just saying, because it looks cool, they come up with a bunch of things that end up being important to future plots, mm-hmm. or just are dropped, but there's interesting things that make the world feel like an expansive place mm-hmm. when it's not.
Yeah.
Really it's not, because the purpose of this world existing is to tell a specific kind of story.
Right.
And that was definitely true in the case of Dune.
Right, for sure.
I'm a huge Tolkien fan. Anyone who's been around me for 10 minutes knows this.
Yeah.
One of the things that is very strange about explaining Tolkien, and you guys have been on the business end of this from me, which is that if you have a very specific question about something, I have to branch out into four different things that I first must establish before I can explain. It's like I start going, well, what's the deal with Aragorn? Why wasn't he king already? Well, and then I have to explain that, Gondor, and then there's the Kingdom of Arnor. They're kind of like the Eastern and Western Roman Empire, and then they split and they fell. And, I actually have to explain that they are the exile realms of the island of Numenor, which is sort of like the Atlantis myth. And then I go, I have to explain where that comes from. And then I'm explaining the War of Wrath and Melkor and the two trees of Valinor. And pretty soon I'm talking about the fucking creation of the universe.
Yeah.
And the thing is...
Why?
That's one of the things that Tolkien hammered his brain over, is that he had been writing a mythology from the time he was like a teenager. And all of these myths read more like history than they do like a series of interconnected stories, because if you change one element or pull one thread in one of them, you start having to change things in other things, and you're like, well, then I lost that. So he had written like four different versions of this.
I mean, you have an advantage in that people know what Lord of the Rings is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I have that advantage now too, but it doesn't feel the same for some reason. Where if you say Lord of the Rings, as a Dune fan for most of my life, now imagine as a Lord of the Rings fan, where as a shorthand, you have to use Willow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, it's like in Willow, but blah. And I go, oh, I get it. Like, well, you don't, but you get enough. Yeah, we can continue. And that's kind of what it was with me in Star Wars, is why they all got swords? Jedi? All right. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on.
I think it's very strange, because I think a lot of it with Tolkien is that he rewrote his mythology so many times, and then he wrote the Lord of the Rings, and now he had to backwrite all of this stuff that he had into the thing he'd already done, adding characters that he had built up as being really important going back into the Elder Days, and now he had to sort of alter it. And then he would make a massive decision saying for an element of internal consistency or in verisimilitude. And he would spend his whole life hammering his brain over something that he might never publish, and he never did in his lifetime.
Right.
And it's so weirdly often inconsistent with different versions of it in different levels of completion, in different drafts. They're not all necessarily consistent with each other. And that's what his son had to dig through.
Right.
So that's the thing, is that people do know the Lord of the Rings.
And it did a apparently a very creditable job compared to certain other sons of famous authors I could be mentioning right now.
See, that's the thing, is Christopher Tolkien was very much his father's son. Mm-hmm. He really was the guy who was sort of birthed into obsessively caring about a lot of the same things that his father did. Like, you know, there were different editions of The Lord of the Rings, different drafts that came out. And, Tolkien would have fights with the publisher about, you can't say, it's not elf-ish, it's elvish, dwarvish, not dwarf-ish. And then, you know, no, you have to have an accent mark over this imaginary language. This way that you wrote it is not the way the grammar works in this imaginary language, because this is all incredibly important to him.
Yeah.
And his son was somebody who was very much of that same mindset and was very kind of jealously holding on to it. I think that if it had not been for Tolkien himself selling movie rights, I believe in the 60s, to pay a tax bill, that we wouldn't have any of these things, because I don't think his son ever would have sold the movie or animation rights.
Yeah, that sounds about right. They've been, the estate is really protective.
Yeah, his son actually does not like the Peter Jackson movies.
Yeah.
I like them a lot, and they're kind of grandfathered into a lot of stuff, but I like the books so much better. But anyways, I guess the thing I was saying about my thought experiment too, and how immortal characters fuck with it, is that Gandalf participated in the creation of the universe.
Right.
So
right.
He's technically been in the quote same room as God.
Right.
And the same thing with like the devil. And technically, anytime immortal characters are bouncing around, he's been there forever. Now, he's not involved or in the same room with most of the characters in the Silmarillion.
So by the time of like the novels, is he just slumming it by that point? Like, what's the? I don't want to know.
What, Gandalf?
Yeah.
Oh, Gandalf is mostly living in the blessed realm of Valinor as a spirit.
All right.
And it's only when he's sent on a mission that he's put in an old man's body, and his power is veiled so that he can't come in direct power opposition or to try to lead people. He has to sort of run around and inspire people and that sort of stuff. He has a very specific task, and I think the fact that he's in an old man body is in a way to sort of humble him.
So I mean I know that the two constants in life are death and taxes, but me being me and being adjacent to historians and linguists, specifically linguists, stuff like that. I think I've got that. I've got a third, and it's death, taxes, and intricate explanations of J.R.R. Tolkien material.
Yeah, there's no escape from it.
You think it's just you. There has always been this person. There has never been a time in my entire existence where there wasn't somebody who was ultimately willing to explain any aspect of any of Tolkien's work to me at any time, to any level of complexity I've ever wanted. Like, I know what Wikipedia is like, but only specifically about Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Do you want to hear something that may blow your mind?
Okay, sure.
I've been reading a lot about Tolkien, especially once the pandemic started. I read Silmarillion, and I read Unfinished Tales. And the thing is, once you get past those two books, you start getting into territory that's just like DVD extra features and multiple drafts of all this stuff. Like in earlier drafts, Aragorn was first, you know, Strider was first a hobbit named Trotter who had wooden feet. There's all these weird previous drafts of it. But anyways,
I heard Trogdor. You can't correct me.
There's a lot of stuff in there, but Tolkien wrote most of this stuff in private with no chance of ever publishing it for decades. This was like a weird private project. He even referred to it as his private and beloved nonsense. And he was very self-deprecating about it. And I think there's an earlier letter that he wrote. The Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien is a really interesting read. He is a fascinating dude.
Yeah.
He has a very specific brain where I really think he was a human... of a certain type that was never intended for mass production. But, and his son is probably a lot like him, but is still more able to relate to most people, because Tolkien will write a letter where he's like, I need to explain something, but first I need to write 10 pages that explains the entire Silmarillion to you. And if you're somebody living in a world where this book has not been published, I can imagine how fucking strange it would be to, like, you're explaining, oh yeah, and this is when the Dark Lord Melkor teamed up with a giant spider named Ungoliant and killed the two trees of Valinor, Telperion and Lorelin, and you're just like, what the fuck is this dude talking about? And then the Noldor went into exile. And
do you want bacon with your pancakes? Yes or
yeah,
no?
Yeah. So, I mean, all of this stuff was private, and the only people reading it were like the Inkling. So, like, you know, like Charles Williams and C.S. Lewis and his son were like the only people who knew the fuck he was talking about. And his letters, he would frequently reference things in his unpublished books as like metaphors to sort of explain to people what he meant. Like when he was talking to his son, you know, who's serving in World War II, he would just refer to the worst sorts of, you know, kill crazy, mindless, stupid, violent people as orcs. Mm-hmm. And there's orcs on every side of every war, as he sort of believed it.
Yeah.
And so it's this entire imaginary world that unless you know him personally, you might not know what the fuck he's talking about. And if he didn't have a bunch of friends that were also writers that righted fantasy, he might have never had an expression for this. So in a lot of ways, because The Hobbit, which started the ball rolling, was a children's story for his kids, only got published because it fell in the hands of the son of a publisher,
right,
who loved it and got him to publish it, because that was the publisher that published both Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. This could have been this weird mass of papers that they found on his death. And it could have been this weird private project and people trying to go, what the fuck are all these symbols? What is this stuff? What is this map? And
yeah. If it didn't get published as a novel, it sounds like something that somebody might have tried to turn into a religion.
Yeah, that's what he was afraid of, too. Once he got a fan base, he kind of got freaked out at the idea that people might take this stuff seriously and start chanting Elvish at each other. He actually was very conscious of that.
That ship sailed.
But it was weird because he was always kind of weird about this private thing that had been his, and he'd been writing the story about, you know, Arendil the Mariner and stuff since he was serving in like World War One, and all of the stories about the fall of Gondolin and, you know, all of this stuff. If he hadn't had the outlets that he had to get this stuff published, he could have been Henry Darger.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know what's really weird? Here's the part where I blow your mind. It took all that lead up to this.
Okay.
Henry Darger and J.R.R. Tolkien were both born in the same year and died in the same year.
What?
Wow.
Whoa.
They were both born in 1892 and they both died in 1973.
Okay.
And if not for a couple different circumstances in his life where Tolkien was encouraged and given an opportunity and an education and was surrounded by other creative people, the entire legendarium of Middle Earth could have ended up the way that we'd seen Henry Darger. And Henry Darger, anyone who doesn't know, was a hospital janitor who, upon his death in like his his early 80s, it was discovered that he'd written like a 10,000 page self-illustrated, both with collages and his own drawings and paintings, massive, strange, kind of little iffy fantasy novel.
Yes.
Also, he was definitely working a lot of his own stuff out, including Tolkien the same way. His religious beliefs and everything sort of out. And it was incredibly important to him, and nobody knew about it during his life.
Yeah.
And if circumstances had happened differently, this could have been something that had happened to Tolkien if The Hobbit had never gotten published. That we probably would have seen him publish a new translation of Beowulf as he did, and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and a lot of the other things that he did. But we may have never found anything else about this Elvish language that he created. And then he had to explain, well, who speaks this language that I'm creating? Okay, well, now I'm going to explain the migration of the elves, and I have to explain how they splintered in all these different little tribes, and now I need to create a map so that I can explain why they splintered at the various time. I also have to describe the life cycle of an elf.
I mean,
it's like all this stuff, and then he told a story based on all of that.
This is all Tolkien, obviously, and he's the archetype now that we measure, like, significant works of literature that have fully realized worlds, right?
Yeah,
or have at least grandly realized worlds. Well, this is my thought: do you give all this credit to Tolkien, despite the fact that he clearly was like doing the same sort of history that's in the Bible, for example?
Yeah.
So it's very much inspired by the type of mythos people in the West would have drawn from growing up with the Bible as mythology.
Because there's a lot of, if you look at his mythology, there's a lot of the Bible, there's a lot of the Finnish Kalevala, there's a lot of Norse and even Greek mythology. And I think he specifically wanted it to be something that was English.
Yeah.
But he also never really particularly was a big fan of King Arthur, because King Arthur was largely Welsh and French.
Yeah.
And also, this is a weird thing with him, is I'm fascinated with this dude's brain, because he will hate certain things. And like
the Irish?
Oh, no. He didn't like the Irish language, though. I have a pretty good idea of languages he liked. He really loves Finnish.
Yep.
He really likes Welsh. He doesn't like Irish language. He likes
Finnish.
Spanish
is like catnip to linguists. It's so weird.
It's weird. That's why Quenya, the it's sort of like Elvish Latin, is based off of Finnish, and why Sindarin, the sort of standard Elvish language that most of the characters in Lord of the Rings speak, is based off of Welsh.
Okay.
So there's a lot of those. It's very weird.
So bizarre.
But again, I think the idea is that if Lord of the Rings had never gotten published, if The Hobbit had never gotten published, if this stuff hadn't proven to have a fan base, then this would all look like madness. This would look insane.
Because maybe it was.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a very specific kind of brain. But the idea of creating world building on this scale, I mean, nobody's ever matched this. Nobody's ever... I just read some of the last published works of Tolkien, and a lot of it was... It's in a book called The Nature of Middle-earth that just came out last year. There are number charts explaining the relative aging of elves.
Okay.
And later in his life, he made a couple changes you pull one thread and I have to recreate the world. So he's like, okay, well, the elves are migrating west. At what point of their life is there a point where they have kids? Because it can't be forever, because then you'd be overrun. This place is lousy with elves.
Right.
And they'd be overrunning everything. So there'd have to be a part of their life where they have kids. So how do I make sure that I can match this up to stuff that's already in the published Lord of the Rings that is hard canon at this point? So I know that Elrond is this age and he has his three children at these ages. How do I match that up and try to figure out how old physically is Elrond during all of this? And it's fucking insane. The level of internal consistency. One of the things he hated about the King Arthur stuff is he didn't want the English mythology to be post-Christian.
Okay.
Because he thought that was...
That's interesting.
He didn't want any mentions of Christianity in it, which is why there are no churches, an organized religion in Middle-earth. For the most part, there are no clergy in all of Middle-earth anywhere. You don't see it anywhere. And he didn't want anything that, one, contradicted his own private religious beliefs.
Right.
But also, he didn't want anything where things from the future sort of polluted the past. Like, he really thought that the Christianity and the Holy Grail stuff of Arthur made it not English.
Okay.
It took it from another Eastern culture's mythology.
Right.
So that's what he really hated about Narnia, is that the Christ story hasn't happened yet. Yet, Santa Claus is at the beginning of the story. and he's like... And they always say that it's always winter in Narnia, but never Christmas. He's like, what the fuck is Christmas? And he's like, and he's just like, what do these people in Narnia think Christmas is if they haven't had a Christ story yet? What is it? Why do they call it Christmas? And it's stuff like that, sort of insane attention to internal consistency, where he would just go nuts over this shit. Like in the appendices of The Lord of the Rings, there is a segment where he goes, okay, well, obviously this book is written in English, and I write the language that the hobbits and Aragorn and everyone speak in English, but what they're really speaking is a language called Westron, which is derived from Adunaic, which is the Numenorean language, and their real names aren't like Bilbo Baggins. This is what his real name is, but it's translated into Bilbo Baggins because I'm translating from that language. So and he named all of the hobbits and various. It's insane. Where he's like, well, obviously they're not really speaking English back then, and here's what their names sounded like. But it's that's what I mean by the level of this looks like madness if it wasn't attached to a thing everyone would love.
So I guess to make it sociological for a moment, like. Would a barometer for how healthy your society is be how you treat your Tolkiens when they appear.
Well, like, we didn't nail him to anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's kind of my point, is you do have a spectrum of murder and incarceration and deprivation. And then you go through, like, if you could use Henry Darger as a midpoint, and on the other side you've got J.R.R. Tolkien. And
Tolkien is like the best case scenario.
Right.
Because he was given the environment where he could thrive.
Right.
And where people came to appreciate what
he had. Because he had a saleable scale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a funny thing, too, is I look at Tolkien on this level, and I also
he was already, before he published anything, he was already like a professor, right?
Yeah.
So he just, the educational institutions that were around him were supportive enough to take a very eccentric person who loved books, love words and stuff, and be able to like support them, right?
Yeah,
and there were institutions that would be able to support a very eccentric personality.
Yeah, he was obsessed with language, and I think the key of it, the story that always gets told, is that he wrote a story when he was a little kid and showed it to his mom, and he wrote something saying there's a character called a green great dragon, and his mom corrected him and said, no, it's a great green dragon. And that correction made him go, why does one work and not the other? And he became obsessed with why one of these things is right and why one of these things is wrong. And it started him down a path where he just became obsessed with the uses of language. And again, this is a sort of thought process that could lead to madness, where you are scribbling constantly about imaginary beings in their imaginary language in a world that never existed, and getting to insane granular detail about it. And When you read a lot of the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, one of the things that really, really gets to me is that he is a frequently pedantic person.
You think?
Yeah, who is just impossible to be around, because the first guy, I think his name was Unwin, the first guy, I think Stanley Unwin was the publisher of the Hobbit. And his son, Rainer Unwin, is the 9-year-old kid who loved it so much that he got his dad to publish it. And it's very clear by about the 1950s that Stanley Unwin can't deal with J.R.R. Tolkien. That he's just like this fucking guy again. And and that Rainer Unwin is the one who takes over the letter writing to Tolkien, because he's the guy who can deal with it.
Mm,
and
right.
That's the thing, is that's a lot cool. of this is just like reading between the lines. And the other things you kind of get is that Tolkien is pushy and just free. I feel like I love his writing, but I probably couldn't stand to be around him for a very long time. And also that, like, C.S. Lewis is like a total pushover, that Tolkien kind of pushes around a lot, and they get into arguments, and you get the impression that Tolkien just can't let something go, and that Lewis is just kind of like, okay, geez. That's what it kind of comes across as a lot of the time. So it's fascinating, where I'm like, this guy's brain is just utterly fascinating. It's why it's so hard for me to find a podcast about him, because I want stuff that is both comprehensive and by people who absolutely love this source material, but I don't want them to be so weirdly like treating him like a guru or being something where you're uncritical of it, because when you get into the messy stuff, that's the really interesting stuff.
Right. Okay, so I knew once we drove this car into... I knew we were going to end up talking about Tolkien the minute somebody mentioned Dune.
Because
that's usually how this conversation
Apologies.
Goes.
We have enough history to know that we had the same conversation a few times.
I'm pulling the wind. I see the Coriolis storm happening. I'm going to get out of its way.
Yeah.
But to take it back to the point that brought us here, which I'm still kind of, I'm curious to where is the intersection between Tolkien and your 2 degrees of
Luke Skywalker.
Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, if you let it, Lord of the Rings definitely like passes there. Like
it passes because it's insanely branched out, where
right.
everything is happening in the, it's kind of like, it's like if you say, well, World War II is your franchise. It's like, is everyone in the room with Churchill?
Sure as hell works
or Hitler.
Disney.
I think Hitler would be the main character of World War II. But it's like... But that's
actually, that's literally an argument I made about the Dune movie, oddly enough, with somebody who was making complaints like Bechdel test stuff. It's like, yeah. I'm not ready for a magical white boy movie. And I'm like, well, when you make a movie about Hitler,
yeah,
Hitler's going to come up a lot.
Yeah.
Paul's not the good guy.
Right.
Yeah. That's the thing. I've kind of wondered that too. And I think we had this conversation before, which is, do you think, I think this would have been less publishable, but do you think that this misunderstanding of Dune would have not been there if the entirety of the book Dune had included Dune Messiah?
No, I think you'd still have it. Because, I mean, honestly, Dune Messiah kind of... Dune Messiah does not cover the war at all.
Mm-hmm.
Does not cover the jihad. It doesn't. It's by the time you get to Dune Messiah, he's back, you know, he's back on Arrakis.
Billions of people are dead.
40 billion people are dead. Like 20 planets have been completely sterilized. Not depopulated, sterilized, and now he's just kicking back.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's literally Dune Messiah until the Stoneburner happens is kind of Paul Atreides on vacation. You know, I mean,
there is kind of a Dr. Manhattan always element to Paul Atreides, that the guy who can see everything but can't stop it.
Well, in the yes, and in the appendices of Dune, one of the things that Herbert makes really clear is that this is kind of his take on a superhero story.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. It's like, this is what a superhero would be like. Trust me, it's not cool.
No.
You know, he had a lot of themes he was trying to tell with this one story. He was making this tool do a lot of work.
Yeah.
And that was one of them, is it does, like, when you're first reading it as a kid, it really does seem like a royal prince, you know, prince takes over the world and wins and everything like that.
You think it's a King Arthur story.
You think it's a King Arthur story. And then you go back and read it 2 years later.
It's so not.
And you're like, holy cats. And you read it two years after that, you're like, everything is a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Bene Gesserit are like monsters. And a lot of this is their fault because they thought that you could create a god being that they could use as a weapon against the universe. And then it turns out they don't control it. And that's their biggest objection to
it. They were trying to avoid something a little, what they thought was worse.
Yeah.
And
wait. Is Paul Atreides the Kwisatz Haderach, or is his son the Kwisatz Haderach, or is his sister the Kwisatz Haderach? Or are they all? Is this like a Trinity thing?
We could talk
Father,
about
the
this,
Son, the Holy Ghost.
We could talk about this a long way. Like there are many interpretations of this. I don't think there is a canonical interpretation, but my interpretation is there is not a Kwisatz Haderach. It was not something that
Just fiction, all fiction, right? It was all a fable.
It was something that could definitely build and definitely work for. But the powers that the Kwisatz Haderach required, and then, you know, the all the things that the Kwisatz Haderach had to be able to do, which is to do everything that the Bene Gesserit could do, and be a man,
right,
and have all of the tools necessary to lead a galactic empire.
Right.
And to not destroy humanity, because that was literally like, please no killing everyone. We've been through this. It sucks. And then, but all the skills they wanted, and then they wanted it to be completely subservient to the Bene Gesserit. You cannot have all of these things and have something that's completely subservient.
Sure.
And in fact, is it, I think it's, is it Dune Messiah? Yeah, it's Dune Messiah with Cytale Cytale and the conspiracy against Paul are meeting together in front of the Navigator, because the Navigator can block prescience. And he's like, Cytale says to Moheim, yeah, we created a Kwisatz Haderach of our own. We created our own ultimate being. And he's like, oh, really? What happened? Killed himself.
Yeah. Wow.
As it happens, you cannot create a thing and then ask that thing to become the opposite of what it is.
Right, wow.
And so in my interpretation of it, there's no such thing. You cannot have a successful Kwisatz Haderach. Mm. And so the closest thing you get are Paul and Leto the Second, technically the Third, and but nobody likes to talk about the original Second Leto because he gets stabbed.
Yeah.
Shyanna later on.
That is a bit weird
on.
That he has two Leto the Seconds.
That's because that's actually kind of referencing something that they would do back in the olden days.
Because a lot of babies didn't make it back.
Yeah, if your baby didn't make it, they just made another one. So you're in now.
I guess you're the new Leto. You're not Leto the Third.
Yeah.
But I mean, the idea that...
Leto 2A.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if you're the second Leto the Second, I guess Leto the Second squared.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that name? That's a little bit weird. You're kind of like, well, what do we call that other kid? That other kid who didn't make it. The ethics of reusing a baby name are a little strange. I mean, royals are just fucking weird.
Well, it wasn't just royals who did that. Okay, the reason I knew this is because the Mormons did some background research on me because they wanted to.
Are you the Kwisatz Haderach Sims?
No, I'm a failed one. In that my family in Massachusetts would have a kid would die, they'd name that kid after the last, they because they Arthur was a family name and I still carry it, it's the A in my name. Mm-hmm. And they would always have an Arthur, and if that Arthur died, they'd make another one.
Ooh. Wow,
the Irish are weird.
Yeah, well there's Babies didn't
yeah. make it.
Maybe
so,
hold off
so
on the name for a little bit.
The attachment that we see of children, of very young children these days, may not have been there because it's like, wait a minute.
It's like, I really like that name.
It's a good name, and dropsy might happen. I don't even know what dropsy is.
Oh, God.
Okay,
oh,
dear Lord. But I guess the thing I was thinking about as far as prophecy goes in a lot of fiction, I think my favorite interpretation of prophecy as a story element is a real chicken and egg question. Mm-hmm. Where, and this, I think this goes for Dune, it also goes for Song of Ice and Fire. And the more I read Dune, the more I realized how much it influenced A Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, sure.
When you started describing to me, like, A Song of Ice and Fire, and then I'd presage, like, a plot point, and I'd go, well, what? Like, Dune.
There's a lot of Dune. There's a lot of Dune, a lot of Tolkien, a lot of other things.
Yeah. The thing about George R. R. Martin, though, is that he does not refrain from telling you what his influences are.
No, he'll tell you straight out where he swipes something from. That world book he wrote has tons of in-jokes in it. It does talk about the Yellow King of Carcosa at one point.
That's my favorite one.
There's a ton of them hidden in there. But I like the chicken and egg idea of a prophecy where a bunch of people created a prophecy. And is it coming true because the prophecy is true, or is it coming true because a bunch of people believe in the prophecy?
Right.
And are actively working to fulfill it. So I kind of like that, where you're like, do we really believe in the Kwisatz Haderach? Or have we created an imaginary thing and then we try and make it?
Well, it's also the interesting thing in Dune, in that it wasn't just the spiritual and mythological things that were congealing to make Paul the Kwisatz Haderach. It was the incredible favorable sociopolitical things that he was experiencing. The fact that Caladan was so profitable. The fact that his family was up and coming and had a military cadre that was as well trained as the Emperor's own shock troops, which was, because of the political scheme, was like something that wasn't supposed to happen. You know, this is like one state having a better military than the entire United States. It's like, no, that's not how
they don't want. That's the big lie of the Black Panther movie. Because if the character played by Martin Freeman, who is a CIA operative, found out that Wakanda was Wakanda and not the Wakanda they thought it was, it would just mostly make textiles and is a poor country, but has Star Trek technology, he would absolutely fucking poison T'Challa right away. That is the truth. He would absolutely, they were like, there is no fucking way. But yeah, I was just thinking about my thought experiment. Does it hold up in any way, or is this?
Well, I don't know what you're testing. Like, if a series or if an
intellectual property
passes the 2 degrees of Luke Skywalker test, what does that say about it? Does it say something about the viability of the world building? Does it say something about the success of it as an intellectual property? Because, like, Star Wars is never going to escape Luke Skywalker.
No.
Star Trek is never going to escape Spock.
No.
They keep fucking recasting him.
Yeah. How many Spocks are we on at this point? Not counting kid Spocks.
Four?
I think so.
Not, you know, and it sounds like when I talk like that, it sounds like I'm about to go on some sort of rant about New Trek or whatever and blah, blah, blah. No, I think it's fine. It's okay.
It's we're in a place now where there are powerful producers who knew they have a money thing and they don't want to move too far away from a thing that your casual fan would understand and feel drawn towards. It's why Spock is the thing that a lot of people who don't know Star Trek super well, they immediately recognize Spock. He's the biggest cultural creation of Gene Roddenberry.
Right.
Though I'd really argue DC Fontana really created Spock as we know him. So I guess the question of, well, what am I trying to accomplish with this thought question? Maybe the point I'm making is that we have the illusion rather than the reality of really expansive, immersive worlds. and that I'd like them to be willing to, and maybe this is a fool's errand, move a bit further away from the central core of what they're marketed as and really do branch out into new places with new kinds of stories, because otherwise we just get in kind of the Disney vortex of let's just recreate Pinocchio again. Let's just recreate something that is familiar and knowable and in a lot of ways acts as a giant anchor on new stories and new characters and new worlds and new voices.
So maybe a direction, so it might be an indicator of the direction that the story line is in. Like, for example, if it passes this test, it might be viable for a, you know, there definitely is a focus on story writing, where if it doesn't consistently does not pass this test, they're more about mining the IP for as much resource as they can.
Right. That sounds closer to the yeah.
Okay.
Are you really willing to? Do you want to tell stories about this universe, or are you just trying to maximize profitability, so
right.
to speak? And that's not always true, because sometimes a story is just about a small group of people.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. It's not a question of franchise good, franchise bad.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.